continuing with our series tonight, looking at the Ten Commandments. As you may remember from last week, I've changed the order just a bit, so that next week we'll be looking at the seventh commandment, do not commit adultery. I thought that that would be wise to look at some issues of lust and sexual purity when we probably have more people and more college students here. Next week is do not covet. We'll finish 2 weeks from now. And then on the 13th, just to remind you, we're going to have a week or two of an Ask the Pastor. So I've gotten some emails, but we need more. So send me an email, drop a note in my box. If there's a biblical question, a theological question, something you'd like to know, now's the opportunity to get those to me in the next few weeks. And we'll take a week or two, depending on how many questions there are. And I'll try to address some of these questions that maybe have been percolating in your minds. Tonight, we're looking at the commandment, do not lie or do not bear false witness. I don't know if any of you have noticed, but there is a very interesting pattern throughout the first books of the Bible as related to the Ten Commandments. Now, it's not a perfect pattern. I've read at least one book that tries to make it into a perfect pattern, and you got to tweak some things, but it's pretty close. That the first 10 books in the Old Testament each correspond with the first 10 commandments. That there is a unique incident, and in many of the books, it's the one incident that comes to mind, and it corresponds with one of the 10 commandments. Now, in order for this to make some sense, you need to realize what the order of the books is in the Hebrew Bible, which is different than our English Old Testament. The order goes like this: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, and Ruth is later. Joshua, Judges, Samuel, which is all one book, and then the Kings. So those are the first 9 books in the Hebrew Bible. Genesis. Now here's where you do have to tweak it a little bit. But Genesis, the first commandment, is that you worship God alone. And the whole theme in Genesis is God picking a peculiar people for himself, starting with Abraham, bringing them out of idolatry and paganism to worship this one God, that he would be the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, just one God. Now the second commandment is you don't make graven images. And the second book of the Bible is Exodus. What's the main sin incident you think about in the book of Exodus? The golden calf. Idolatry. Violation of the second commandment. Leviticus, less familiar to us, but I read this story in Leviticus chapter 24. With a man who blasphemes the name of the Lord. It corresponds with the third commandment. To reverence God's name. In Numbers chapter 15, there is an peculiar incident about a Sabbath breaker who is executed for picking up sticks on the Sabbath. So you have both in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, you have an incident of sin that corresponds with the commandment and is punished by death. Deuteronomy. I mentioned Deuteronomy chapter 21 when I preached on the fifth commandment. There's an incident of a man who dishonors his father and mother and how you are to put to death a rebellious son. Then the sixth book, Joshua. Can anyone think what's a particular sin incident that sticks out in the book of Joshua? Achan. Stealing. Some of the devoted things. So here's the order gets a little bit off because murder, stealing, and adultery are mixed around. That's why it's not a perfect pattern. Judges. There's lots of sins to pick from in Judges. Anyone think of the example? I think I mentioned it when I preached on do not murder. Gruesome story at the end of Judges about killing the Levite's concubine. And then Samuel, what's the sin you immediately think of in the book of Samuel? David and Bathsheba, adultery. Which brings us to the 9th book in the Hebrew Bible, the Kings. And here we have a particular incident regarding false witnesses, the 9th commandment. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 21. Some people have tried to argue that in the first 9 books of the Bible, you have God, or people might say, well, it's not God, it's just some editor or something, but you know, it's God who is trying to show, book by book, the consequences for violating each of the Ten Commandments. In 1 Kings chapter 21, we have a violation of the Ninth Commandment, page 303. We'll pick up at verse 8. This is the story of Ahab, who's the king, a wicked king in Israel, and his wife Jezebel. And there's a man next door who has a vineyard, Naboth, and they want it, and he won't sell it to him. So Jezebel devises a plan how to get the vineyard from him. In verse 8, so she wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal, and she sent the letters to the elders and the leaders who lived with Naboth in his city. And she wrote in the letters, proclaim a fast and set Naboth at the head of the people, and set two worthless men opposite him, and let them bring a charge against him, saying, you have cursed God and the king. Then take him out and stone him to death. And the men of his city, the elders and the leaders who lived in his city, did as Jezebel had sent word to them. As it was written in the letters that she had sent to them, they proclaimed a fast and set Naboth at the head of the people. And the two worthless men, why two? Because you cannot convict somebody on fewer than two witnesses, came in and sat opposite him, and the worthless men brought a charge against Naboth in the presence of the people, saying, Naboth cursed God and the king. So they took him outside the city and stoned him to death with stones. Then they sent to Jezebel, saying, Naboth has been stoned, he is dead. Exodus 20, verse 16 says, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And here's a classic example. Two witnesses, outright lies, leading to the death of an innocent man, bearing false witness. So we often think of the Ninth Commandment as do not lie, and that's, you know, lying's a bad thing too. We'll talk about that. But it is in particular a courtroom situation having to do with witnesses. Witnesses are important in our courtroom. They were everything in the ancient world. You didn't have wiretapping, hidden cameras. You didn't have DNA testing. You had witnesses. Deuteronomy 17, verse 6. On the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses, the one who is to die shall be put to death. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. So you need at least two. This is serious. And everything depended that these witnesses were trustworthy. And being a witness, especially in a capital punishment crime, was so serious that Deuteronomy 17, verse 7 goes on to say, the hand of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. So if you are going to bring a charge against somebody, and you're going to be a witness, you're going to be the first one to grab the stone and enact the execution. 1 Timothy 5:19 says, do not admit a charge against an elder except on the evidence of two or three witnesses. So even the leaders get a fair shake. You need two witnesses. God sets it up this way because he cares deeply about justice. The judges need to be impartial. That's why in the Western tradition of jurisprudence, you'll often have a picture of Lady Justice and she's holding scales and she has a blindfold because justice is supposed to be blind. Not supposed to look at if you have a lot of money or if you're poor or what color you are. You hear both sides and render judgment. The Ninth Commandment is here to protect so many of the other commandments. Your life, do not murder. If you have a false witness, you end up murdering an innocent person. Your property, do not steal. False witness could end up taking your vineyard like it did for Naboth. Do not commit adultery. You need somebody to tell the truth about what's going on in your marriage. We expect lies. You just turn on the news. You don't expect people to be telling the truth. So you have Roger Clemens, who said, I didn't take steroids. You have his trainer, who says, I injected him, you know where, this many times, and his wife, go figure. And it just, no, yes, no, yes, no, I didn't, yes, I did. It was hardly bat an eyelash. Well, somebody's lying, that's what we expect. We expect politicians to make promises they don't keep, friends to exaggerate, people to write memoirs that aren't true. My sister took a creative writing class in college, and one of the assignments was to write your memoirs. I don't know what you have to write about when you're 18, but, you know, write some memoirs. And maybe it's because you don't have much to write about. They even encourage, hey, you know, just how you remember or how it feels to, even if, you know, these things didn't really happen, just sort of what you think might have happened or should have happened. We don't expect honesty. Telling the truth is important to God. Let me give you a number of reasons why. Number one, because of the nature of God himself. 1 Samuel 15:29, the glory of Israel is not a man that he should lie or regret. God doesn't lie. Romans 3:4, let God be true, though everyone were a liar. Of course, Jesus himself says, I am the way, the truth, the life. So it's the nature of God to only speak what is true. That's why telling the truth is important. Number two, if it's the nature of God to tell the truth, it is the nature of the devil to lie. Jesus says in John 8:44 that he is the father of lies. We see this all the way back in the garden, Genesis chapter 3, when the serpent tempts Adam and Eve. Has God really said? How can we know? Can we be sure? Can we understand what God says to us? He's a liar. You think about that next time you want to just give a little white lie, an exaggeration about your inflated GPA. Hey, the GPAs are so inflated anyways, you don't need to exaggerate anymore. It is the nature of the devil himself to lie. It's his way, and not just bold-faced falsehood. That's not actually the way of the devil. His way is subtlety, half-truths, misleading statements, presenting the bait, and hiding the hook. And when we don't tell the truth, it's not very often probably that most of us just call something black when it's white. We're subtle. We twist. We misrepresent. We give our interpretation of things as the facts. It's the way of the devil. Number three, telling the truth is important because words are important. We live in a day when words are cheap. I often feel like they're cheap. I say so many of them. They're everywhere. You can read umpteen million blogs. Everybody's got an opinion about something. Everybody can write it. You can read it. But God invented words. We communicate by words. He communicates by words. God not only hallows the whole sphere of language and communication, but he considers it an extension of his being in some way. You think about what it means for communication theory in language that Jesus was the Word made flesh. God communicates to us through verbal utterances, and most importantly, he communicates most clearly in the person of his Son. But you can't separate those two. It's the Word spoken, inscripturated to us, and it's the Word clothed in human flesh in the person of Jesus Christ. Words were God's idea. People sometimes think, well, how can we really know what God thinks? It's just a big cloud of unknowing. But the question is, has God spoken? And can God, now, yeah, we're finite, we can't understand, but can God speak in such a way as to be understood, as to communicate? That's why he invented language. Therefore, to reflect the character of God, we must speak true words and take great pains to say what we mean and mean what we say. That honors language and the Word as God does. I know too many examples of people who sign statements of faith or agree to confessions that they don't really believe in, and it's kind of just a wax nose. And John Stott said the definition of an evangelical Christian is somebody who can say the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed without crossing his fingers. Hopefully we mean those things. We mean our words. We must weigh our words carefully, not bear false witness, not lead others to bear false witness. I don't know how many of you have read the play or seen the movie A Man for All Seasons. I've read part of it. I haven't seen it, but I'd like to. But I know that there is a scene. This is about Sir Thomas More, who was a pastor, I guess a priest, during the time of Henry VIII. Henry VIII divorces Catherine, and he wants to marry Anne Boleyn. And Sir Thomas More was a very prominent clergyman, and so people wanted to know what he thought about this divorce. I mean, this is the whole reason that Henry VIII starts the Anglican Church. It's because the Catholic Church wouldn't allow him to get a divorce. Actually, in doing some reading, I figured out, did you know the Vatican has a list of movies? There are apparently 15 movies, and this is one of them, go figure, on the Vatican's must-see list. I think Chariots of Fire was also on there, so we're in good company. But as the story goes in the movie, people want to know, Thomas More, what do you think about the king's divorce and about marrying Anne? And More figures the best thing to do is to be silent, because he knows that anything he says can and will be used against him. And so he doesn't tell anyone. But his silence speaks volumes, and people figure he doesn't like this divorce and this marriage. And so people, the movie, they're hounding him, they're after him. Would you speak? What do you think about this? And at one point, his wife gets very frustrated with her husband. Why won't you tell me? Why won't you at least confide in me? Tell me, what do you think? I'm your wife. Everyone wants to know. You won't even tell me what you think about this marriage. And he says, in effect, to his wife, let me tell you a story. Let me present a scenario for you. Imagine, dear wife, that you are on the witness stand. And the judge says to you, has your husband ever spoken to you about what he thinks about the king's marriage? And there she understands why he won't say anything. Not only because his word is important, but because he knows her word must be important. And he doesn't want to put her in the position of having to send him to the gallows or else bearing false witness and lying. So he says, I'm not going to say anything. So on that day of judgment, you can say, with a clean conscience, my husband never mentioned a word, because he believed that words matter. Number four, the truth is important to God because being a witness matters. Let me just take you through a few places in the Scriptures. You don't have to turn there. I'll just mention them. This whole imagery of being in a court and having witnesses is in more places than you think in the Scriptures. In Exodus chapter 17, the people have gone through the Red Sea. They haven't yet got to Mount Sinai, and they're complaining. Why did God take us out of here? We don't have anything to eat. We don't have anything to drink. They're, in a sense, they're bearing false witness against God. And so there at this place called Meribah, the people gather, and the Lord tells Moses, the Lord says, I am going to come, and I will be here upon the rock. And if you remember the story, Moses strikes the rock. It's as if God is saying, I will take their judgment, their false witness against me, and you can strike me. And then water comes forth. Job is a hard book to understand. All these people coming and going. It's a courtroom scene. And you have a whole series of Job's so-called friends who are presenting their case, and what they want to get from Job is an admission of some guilt. He's on the witness stand, and they want him to enter a guilty plea. And so they keep explaining, Job, you wouldn't be suffering if you hadn't sinned. Come on, admit it. You've sinned, otherwise this wouldn't be happening to you. The minor prophets, most of them act as prosecuting attorneys. They come before Israel or Judah, say, hear ye, the Lord has this against you, and lists all of their sins and calls them to repentance. And there's a frequent problem in both testaments of false witnesses. Matthew 26, false witnesses lead to the death of Jesus. In Acts chapter 6, they lead to the death of Stephen. Listen to Proverbs chapter 6, verse 16. There are six things that the Lord hates, seven that are an abomination to him. Okay, what does the Lord hate? Haughty eyes, so pride, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. Those are seven things the Lord hates. We look at the New Testament and see how important witnesses are. In Hebrews chapter 6, we read that God, in order to make a covenant with Abraham, swore, and since there was no one to swear by greater than himself, he swore by himself. Jesus has this argument in John chapter 8 with the Jewish leaders about witnesses. And he says, I don't need a witness because I am the true witness. And then he says, well, if you need another witness, my Father witnesses to me. Jesus is called the faithful witness in Revelation chapter 1. John chapter 15, the Spirit bears witness to Jesus. Romans chapter 8, the Spirit bears witness to our spirit that we are sons of God. Now, why do I take the time to show you that witness language throughout the Scriptures? Because of Acts chapter 1, verse 8. Jesus says to his disciples before he ascends into heaven, you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you, and you will be witnesses in Jerusalem and all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. God expects us to speak on His behalf in the courtroom of life. God's constantly on trial. He shouldn't be, but He is. Can you believe in Him? Does He exist? Is He good? What about the problem of evil? What about suffering? And He calls us to be witnesses, calling us to the stand. Will you plead for God's case? Not that He needs us, but He uses us. Witness is important. Trustworthy witnesses are imperative. And if you are not known as a trustworthy person, how can you be expected to be considered trustworthy when you talk to others about God? If you exaggerate and you mislead and you jump to conclusions in everyday stuff, who will believe you that you speak precisely and thoughtfully and truthfully and honestly when it comes to the eternal things of God? That's why being a witness matters. Because if you want to bear witness to God, you can't have a witness that everyone knows is full of lies and half-truths. Let me talk for just a few minutes about different kinds of lies. We'll do that, and then we'll finish with the Heidelberg Catechism's answer for what is God's will for you in the Ninth Commandment. Theologians for a long time have distinguished among three different kinds of lies: harmful lies, humorous lies, helpful lies. Harmful lies, we don't have to say anything more about. We've talked about that, bearing false witness. We'll give some more examples in a moment. Humorous. This could be jokes, stories, obvious tongue-in-cheek humor. So theologians have said there's a way that you tell a joke that it's a humorous quote-unquote lie, but everyone understands that you're simply saying something funny. But even joking can be dangerous. Proverbs 26:18 says, like a madman shooting firebrands and deadly arrows is a man who deceives his neighbor and says, I was only joking. So joking can cross the line. You get this picture in your mind here from Proverbs? There's a madman, he's just shooting these fiery arrows. They're just flying all over the place. And one lands in the small of your back, and he laughs and says, it's just a joke. Well, great, your whole backside's on fire. So that's not a humorous lie. That's a real lie. Speaking in a way that is foolish and reckless, even though you may be only joking, it hurts people, and it can lead them astray. My wife graciously tells me that not everyone always gets my oh-so-witty banter, so I need to be careful. Helpful lies. This is the difficult category. Not everyone in church history has agreed on whether a lie might ever be justified. Just think in your head what you would say. Is it ever right to deceive someone intentionally? As I said, I'm very open to arguments on both sides. Let me just give you why I tentatively think that it can be. realizing that that does put you on a slippery slope, but hopefully isn't pushing you down the slippery slope. Is it ever right to deceive another person intentionally? Well, think of some biblical examples. You have in Exodus chapter 1, Shiphrah and Puah. Remember them? They're the midwives. And Pharaoh wants to kill the Israelite children. And Shiphrah and Puah and some of the other midwives, they realize this is an unjust law. They're not going to obey it. So there already you have, what do you do when you're supposed to obey the governing authorities, but the governing authorities give you a command that's unlawful? Well, you obey God rather than obey men. And then when Pharaoh says, how come all these babies are making it through? What, didn't I tell you to kill them? They say, well, look, these Hebrew women, they're just boom, boom, in and out. The babies are just dropping out. They're too fast. They're too vigorous. I suppose it's possible you say, well, that really was the case with the Hebrew women. But we already know that the midwives intentionally were violating this commandment from Pharaoh to save the children. And then they, sure looks like, deceived Pharaoh by explaining how this was happening. And then if you read verses 15 through 20, the Lord blesses them. Or what about Rahab hiding the spies? Hebrews 11 and James 2 praise her for her act. Or you have in 2 Samuel chapter 15, this man by the name of Hushai. David tells him, you go over and pretend to be on Absalom's side and you lie to him. And that way you'll confuse the counsel of Ahithophel. And he does it. Or in 2 Samuel chapter 17, there's women in this town who lie to Absalom's men. And they say, where's Jonathan and Ahimaaz? And they're hiding in the town. And the women say, oh, they just went over there. It seems to be a good thing. There are some historical examples, the most famous of which is hiding Jews during World War II. If you hide a Jew in the Netherlands and the Nazis come to your door, say, are you hiding Jews? What's the right thing to do? That's the question. Now, there's other ways that you can, you know, maybe phrase it, but you still are deceiving. You know, even if you tried to get your words a little differently. For example, Athanasius, the church father, he was always in exile, and they were hunting him down. And there's a story that someone came up to him and said, of course, I mean, you don't have, you know, milk cartons to know what these people look like. They're just looking for Athanasius. And they see him and they say, do you know where Athanasius is? And he says, he's not far from you. Keep looking, you'll find him. Well, telling the truth, I suppose, but he's intending to lead him somewhere else. There's a similar story with a man who was martyred by the name of Hans Bucher. And he was with a number of people sitting down, and the authorities came and they said, is Hans sitting among you? And so he stood up and he said, no, he's not sitting among us. Now you can say, well, sure, well, they told the truth. He stood up. But the intent is still to deceive. I don't think we can separate, in the case of Rahab, for example, that the lie in hiding the spies cannot be separated from the act itself. Either way, even if, you know, you say, well, Rahab's not praised in Hebrew and James because she lied. Even if you say that, she was hiding spies, which by its very nature is sort of deceptive. They are spies. The lie in these cases, many have argued, and I would tend to agree, though I understand it's a slippery slope, can be seen as a part of honoring God and keeping His other commandments in more important ways, to protect life, to honor the true God. And I think it's also worth noting in these examples, I gave you four examples from the Old Testament. All of them are basically in a situation of war. Jericho is about to be at war there. They're taking over. The two examples with Absalom is fighting against David. Shiphrah and Puah, not exactly war between the Israelites and the Egyptians, but God is just about ready to unleash His wrath against their enemies and their oppressors. And so some have argued that there are certain ways in which during wartime, you expect to be deceived. Like, you don't want to be deceived. What I mean is, there are even examples in the Old Testament of God devising the deception. Remember when the Israelites go back and they fight the city of Ai after they lost and they go back? And the Lord tells Joshua what to do. And he says, "Here's, you're going to send some men here and some men there, and you're setting an ambush to mislead them and deceive them." And so in the situation of war with your enemies, there is an understanding that you're trying to win. It's like when playing football and you have a play action pass. You know, that's when you pretend to hand off and then the running back goes through, doesn't really have the ball. I've watched football with a lot of Christians. I've never heard a Christian stand up, "Wait a second! The ninth commandment. Come on. Bearing false witness, holding the ball. That's part of the game." All that to say, I think, if I were in the Netherlands during World War II, I would have had the courage to hide a Jew and to tell the Nazis that they weren't there. Now, you could add a fourth category, polite lies. This gets even trickier. Because sometimes you're polite, and are you lying? I don't think that's what the Lord has in mind. It is an act of love. Let's be honest. It's an act of love that you don't always tell everyone exactly what you're thinking about everything. And people appreciate it, whether they realize it or not. You're all getting together with your friends on a Friday night. "Hey, anybody got a place they want to go for dinner?" "I do! Bennigan's." "Yeah, you said that every week." "Well, you ask every week." "Okay, does anyone feel strong?" "I do!" You have to unload everything you're thinking. Your wife, maybe you're newlyweds, and is a little insecure and asks you, "Honey, did you see so-and-so with her new dress this morning at the wedding? She was pretty, don't you think? Now, what do you say there?" You don't lie, but you may not unload every thought that absolutely gorgeous, honey. Thanks for reminding me. "How do you like the stuffing?" "Terrible." Or you nudge your kids at a meal when you're at a guest house because they gave you the kidney beans and you didn't say thank you, and your son says, "I'm not thankful. I didn't want these." So is it a violation of the ninth commandment? And we laugh, but you think about it. Well, is being polite sinful? And I think the way to understand it is that there are social conventions of speech whereby we understand people don't mean exactly what they're asking us. Someone comes into the room. "Everybody get enough to eat?" "Well, thanks for asking. Could you order something? I'm starving. This was not very good." No, it's sort of a blanket, "How's everything going in here?" sort of question. Probably not an invitation for you to unload your culinary expectations on everyone. And you may think, well, that's a silly question. Don't ask it if you don't mean it. But it is a certain part of social maturity to understand what people mean by the things they say. Now, all of this is not to say that you never tell somebody the hard truth and you just paper over things that are too difficult. Someone may come up to you and say, "Do you think I talk too much?" And you don't have to, "Oh, no, no." But even there, you could be gentle and say, "You know what, can I call you about that later this week? That's a really good question." And there's a way to be honest with people when they're asking an honest question. Well, I want to finish by talking about what is required of us in this commandment. The Heidelberg Catechism asks, what is God's will for you in the ninth commandment? And I think this answer is perfect, just about perfect. God's will is that I never give false testimony against anyone, twist no one's words, not gossip or slander, nor join in condemning anyone without a hearing or without a just cause. Rather, in court and everywhere else, I should avoid lying and deceit of every kind. These are the devices the devil himself uses, and they would call down on me God's intense anger. I should love the truth, speak it candidly, and openly acknowledge it, and I should do what I can to guard and advance my neighbor's good name. I just want to quickly go through that answer. Never give false testimony against anyone. Twist no one's words. We are so good at this. We retell a story or a conversation, and you're always the hero, and he's always the goat. And you're not exactly lying, but you emphasize, you remember the mean things he said, and you sort of forget the hurtful things you said, or you know how to phrase it in such a way that takes the edge off of your comments and puts the edge on her comments. We twist one another's words, or we pass along our interpretations of the story as the facts of the story. So you get into a disagreement with a friend, and you're having some disagreement about a point of theology. And later, when you're recounting this story to another friend, you say, He said I was a heretic. When what he actually said was, that's a very serious error you're making. Now, it feels to you like, well, you might as well just think I'm a heretic. And that interpretation then gets framed in the retelling of the story as the facts. That's why sometimes I hear stories and I hear two people talking about it, and I say, now, were those his words? Because I know I do that. You twist. Not gossip or slander. Man, we could preach a whole series of sermons on this. It's prevalent in the church. I know I've done it. We can gossip in one of two ways. Gossip can be passing along a rumor or report that can't be substantiated. I heard this. I think this is true. You don't know the facts. You pass it on. Or second, passing along a true report unnecessarily. This is where it gets very dicey. How do you know if something is passed along unnecessarily? Here's some questions that I would bring to mind. Would he be happy for others to know that I'm sharing this? If he found out that I shared this with some of my other friends, would he say, thank you, I'm really glad you brought that to their attention? Another question that I ask myself, what will I do as a result of telling this other person? It takes a lot of wisdom. There can be a place to share something that's intimate about somebody else, and you're going to act on it. You're looking for counsel. How do I handle this? How do I go speak to this person? Or it can be a way of forming a bond. We must realize there is no faster way to make a friend than to share an enemy. There's no faster way to make a friend than to share an enemy. You get talking about this person, and that you realize you're both really bugged about the same things and the same person. Man, you will be fast friends. You talk about that. You didn't know, man, she makes you feel that way. Boy, he's that annoying to you. Wow. And it forms a bond. I also ask myself, will my telling this story help to form an overly negative view of this person in someone else's mind? Why should gossip be considered bearing false witness? I mean, you might be saying something that's absolutely true. So how is it deception? Well, I was thinking about that, and it seems to me that it's deception in this way. Even though you may be saying something that is true about another person, you are still bearing false witness if you lead your friend to think worse of this person than they need to. So it isn't that the fact you may be sharing may have happened. Oh, they had that affair. That's true. But you share it, maybe out of context, maybe without a sense of the person's repentance or working on her struggle. And by sharing even something that's true, you can bear false witness by forming in your friend's mind an overly negative interpretation of this other person. Particularly if it is private and if it's being dealt with. As a general rule, if you need to talk about something, first think, do I really need to? If you think you do, keep the circle as small as possible. And we need to be careful that we don't make excuses. I know I've done this before. We all have. You share some juicy tidbit. And then at the end, well, he's a great guy. Well, okay, that doesn't quite undo it all. Or you preface it, I've known this for a while and I haven't said anything. Sort of heroic for your reserve. Or, I shouldn't really say anything, but you'll keep a secret. Proverbs 18:8, the words of a whisperer are like delicious morsels. They go down in the inner parts of the body. Don't we all love hearing that? We love talking about it. We love talking about other people. Beware, and this has to do more with slander than gossip, beware of concocting hypotheses and scenarios in your head and then sharing them with others as fact. This would include putting the worst possible motives on other people's intentions, refusing to give the benefit of the doubt, assuming the worst about others. That's slander. The Catechism goes on, nor join in condemning anyone without a hearing or without a just cause. Jesus says, judge not, or you too will be judged. With the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. We want to be very careful. It doesn't mean we can't form opinions of people, even negative opinions. We want to be careful, and it's something, we're almost out of time here, but it's something Ted and I really tried to do. We wrote this book, you've heard about that, and there's this thing on Tuesday, and you can read it and be the judge if you think we did this well, because, I mean, the book is called Why We're Not Emergent. So it's sort of out there, we're being critical. I think there's a need for that in the church. But we really tried, and I hope we're successful, I don't know, to be careful that we don't condemn someone without really giving them a fair hearing, without listening to them as we would want to be listened to, without just cause, without guilt by association. You like this person, I know this person thinks, then you're guilty. Paul warns against judging rashly. He says in 1 Corinthians 4, therefore do not pronounce judgment before the time, before the Lord comes, who will bring to light the things now hidden in darkness and will disclose the purposes of the heart. You see, Paul said, you know what, God's going to judge everybody one day. So just as a general rule, be cautious about judging. Because God's going to get it all right in the end. So let's just make sure we don't get it wrong. And there's something very biblical about our notion in this country of being innocent until proven guilty. Share this quick story. So I was at jury duty. I didn't finally get seated, which I was thankful for because it was a six-day murder trial. But I was there and went into the courtroom and they went and selected people to be on the jury. And as they were talking some about this case, and it was a homicide case, dealt with drugs, and somebody else had been killed. And so here was the defendant who pled not guilty. And you just heard some of the facts of the case and where this man was and who was there and drugs were involved, and they weren't even disputing that he did drugs or sold drugs. You know, my mind started to think, well, obviously this guy did something. I mean, there's drugs, he was there, someone got killed. Maybe he did. I don't know how the case turned out. That our mind quickly jumps to, there's smoke, there's fire. Boy, they got to be guilty. Jump to the worst possible assumptions. In court and everywhere else, I should avoid lying and deceit of every kind. That means exaggeration. We like to exaggerate how much snow we got, how little sleep you had. Man, I'm going on 2 hours. How much you ate, how long you studied. I've shared this before. I do little dumb things. What time did you get up? Well, about 6:30. It was 6:50. That doesn't get me to the round down place. But you want to seem, I don't know, you want to seem like you get up early, and you just exaggerate all these little things. Avoid making promises you can't keep. Listen to Ecclesiastes 5:5. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. How often do we say something we We maybe have good intentions or no intentions of following up on it. Ecclesiastes says, it's better just, don't even say you're going to do it if you can't really do it. Finally, I should love the truth, speak it candidly, and openly acknowledge it. This is one of the reasons we want to learn, we want to grow, we want to know more Bible, we want to know theology, because we want to know more about God. We love the truth. We want to speak it. We want to know it as it pertains to God and as it pertains to our neighbors. And the catechism ends by saying, I should do what I can do to guard and advance my neighbor's good name. Proverbs 22:1, a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, and favor is better than silver or gold. Listen to Calvin. We delight, this is so true, we delight in a certain poisoned sweetness experienced in ferreting out and disclosing the evils of others. And let us not think it an adequate excuse if in many instances we are not lying. For he who does not allow a brother's name to be sullied by falsehood also wishes it to be kept unblemished as far as truth permits. That convicted me. Do I love my neighbor's good name? Or do I enjoy the poisoned sweetness of finding out evils? What problems are they having that's interesting to me? He's not everything I thought he was. And I find myself in a sinful, wicked way, wishing to hear people be worse than I thought they were, when I should want in everything about me that they would be better than I imagined. I don't know. This, you know, the Lord brought the people here that he wanted here to hear this sermon. But I think, not that I'm never guilty of any of the other commandments, but this one, because I speak so much and I write and I deal with words, it's taming the tongue. I don't know about you, I always feel convicted. There's always enough little conflicts going around in the church that I think, am I really being a man of absolute integrity and how I phrase things here and how I say things here and what I'm really talking about? And it's just so easy. It's the easiest thing in the world. Churches, it's rare that churches get ripped apart because, you know, they're debating infra versus supralapsarianism. It happens because people gossip and they speak ill of one another. And it comes down to Jesus' summary of the Ten Commandments. Do you love God and do you love your neighbor? How would you want someone else to be speaking about you? Would you want them to share that story about you? And I just know there have been times when I have not labored hard to advance my neighbor's good name. Instead, you like it when she gets knocked down a peg or when everyone sees his warts, because you've seen all those warts for years and you want somebody else to recognize them. When we should be laboring, boy, I want people to think good about Alex and about Tim and about Billy, about Dan. I want to do whatever I can. So far, I don't want to lie about, but I want them to have a good name. I don't want to be a part of making people to think worse about them and have these negative impressions. I don't want to bear false witness. I want to love my neighbor just as I would be loved. That's the way of the cross. It's the way of Jesus. Let's pray. Father in heaven, I pray that you would convict us of sin in this regard, because we do have loose lips. We could talk about the lies and Rahab, and those are interesting theological conundrums. But the real heart of the matter for us is that we gossip and we slander, and we don't defend the good name of our brothers and sisters. And we enjoy all the juicy tidbits of people's personal lives more than we ought to. Help us to be so in love with the truth that we seek it in your word. And we seek it vigilantly. As much as we do in the word, we seek it in other people. We labor hard not to spread what is false or unhelpful. Give us your spirit to do this, because we are weak and we will often fail. Forgive us when we do. In Jesus' name, amen.